Good morning and welcome to the School for Successful Ranching. My name is Alexis Cowan and I'm going to be moderating the session today. At this time, I would ask that you would place your cell phones on silent and remove your hats so that everybody behind you can see. There's a table in the back room if you want to set them down there. We would like to take this time to thank our generous sponsors of the School for Successful Ranching for their support for this program and commitment to producer education. They have small displays set up in the hallway on this floor, and we ask that you visit their booths in the expo and say thank you. We couldn't do this program without them. Sponsors include Capital Farm Credit, Dow AgroSciences, Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Merck Animal Health, Stay Tough Fence Manufacturing, Bayer, Microtechnologies, Diacero, Texas Range Minerals, Neogen Genseek, Rabo AgriFinance, and Texas Beef Quality Assurance, along with Sylvanus Insurance Group. If you're a new TSCRA member, we're holding a new member orientation tomorrow at 1 o'clock in room 101. We hope that you can come and learn more about what TSCRA does for you and the cattle industry. Our next presentation is Identifying and Treating Common Illnesses, presented by Dr. Peter Armstrong from Live Oak Veterinary Hospital in Jacksboro. Please help me welcome Dr. Armstrong.
So I'm probably a little more nervous than Dr. Anderson was. He's a little bit older and definitely a lot funnier. But so I was asked to speak about this, and I guess a little bit about me first and where I'm at. So we're I'm an LSU graduate, practiced in Northeast Louisiana for almost 2 years, and then a little over 3 years ago bought a practice in Jacksboro, mixed animal practice. Stay probably 40-50% of our business is food animal work. End of last year, we bought another practice in Henrietta and have kind of expanded that. We're two doctors and expanding to a third now. So, and this is my little one, my two-year-old Pierce. So I want to talk about some common diseases, and kind of what I wanted to do with this was talk about some things that pop up that I see a lot, but also at the end of this, leave plenty of time to ask some questions, right? So what's pertinent to me or to my producers may not be pertinent to you guys. And so I called four or five of my producers and said, hey, what are things, if you were to sit in this class, what would you want to listen to or hear about? And so this is some things that we talked about. Blackleg, really common, but just a reminder there. Some lepto, Dr. Anderson talked about that. Calving difficulties is not going to be a disease, but surely something we get a lot of calls about. Briefly talk about trick, and then foot rot. That's probably tends to be the thing that I see the most of from a real illness that we're treating, you know, periodically that we don't get, you know, taken care of with vaccination. So blackleg, it's a clostridial disease. It's something that's found naturally in the soil. We don't, there's not a good way to prevent them from picking it up. It's ingested through the oral cavity and then goes into the GI tract through the and then into the bloodstream. It spends its time in the muscle, and then we get an animal that gets bumped around or bruised pretty good, and then we'll get that disease show up. And so the most common thing that I'll get is somebody will call me and say, hey, I've got this 6-weight steer that's down. We just weaned them 2 months ago, and they're, you know, it's best-looking steer. He's 600 pounds. Everybody else is 400 pounds. I don't know what's wrong. You get out there, that steer, like I say, he's down. You can touch him. He's got a lot of sub-Q emphysema, and just kind of feels like you're touching bubble wrap there underneath them. And so that's usually a pretty good indication that we're dealing with blackleg. And so that calf is usually never going to make it. And so I put no good treatment because usually I euthanize them. Occasionally, you know, someone will want to try large doses of penicillin repeatedly, but usually it's to no avail. They get really septic and they die very shortly. And probably the most, you know, I probably diagnosed 10 of these. The last one I had, a guy called me out and he said, you know, we had just worked all his steers at the clinic, and so we were I said, well, these are all been vaccinated. Surely we don't have a problem with that. And he had two heifers that had died already and another one down. And he said, well, I never brought the heifers to you. And I said, well, that became very expensive. So the vaccine, you know, is going to cost you 60 cents. So works really good. There's a lot of them. This is just one example of one. But there's a lot of different ones that work out really well. There's, you know, some of those need to be boosted, some don't, but work well. Lepto, Dr. Anderson, those that were here last, he kind of talked on this briefly. So this is a bacterial disease that affects humans, livestock, and wildlife. Humans, that's a big concern, especially when we talk about small animals, dogs that get it. That's actually something that's seen a lot in urban areas, you know, through mice and things like that, are transmitted. So then we worry about the transmission to people. The biggest problem in people with that is kidney failure. Probably the reason to keep that in mind is if you are dealing with aborted fetuses, a lot of those things can be transmitted to us. And so we end up with, you know, someone's helping you pull a calf who just went through chemotherapy, and they go out there and they're messing with this calf, and then they pick up lepto. And so that creates a lot of other problems. So that's just something to keep in mind anytime you're dealing with aborted fetus. Infected urine is going to be our most common transmission. We can see it in the placenta, and then we can see transmission from mom to baby through the milk. Stagnant water, pigs urinating in the water, making wallers, and the cows coming along finding that water and drinking is going to be what happens there. So clinical signs, most common thing we'll see is abortion. The problem with this is usually an after-the-fact deal. And so with our abortions, we don't typically see a great big abortion storms. You're mostly seeing some infertility and things of that nature. We can see some kidney disease, weight loss, appetite loss. Diagnosis becomes very difficult, especially in the absence of aborted fetuses. When we start talking about abortions and someone calls me out and says, hey, I've got an aborted fetus, I'd like to test it and figure out what's going on. I would probably guess 75% of those calves that we test, we don't find a good cause for that. That chance goes up if we have the placenta, but that means you had to beat the mom there to eat it. And so if that happens, if we can see that aborted placenta, a lot of times in that the cotyledons really contain a lot of information there, but we don't always get that. And so we start trying to test calves, we usually don't get information. So then we start looking at the cow. The cow is going to have titers, but if she's had previous vaccinations, that's all that it means, is that we've had an exposure to the disease, and vaccine is, that's what that is. And so as we do those tests, you start to try to diagnose and figure out what's going on there. So that can be a really difficult way. The other way is to do urine cultures, or there's some other further diagnostics that you can take. They take a long time, not only in running those or growing that culture, but also catching urine on 50 cows. That becomes a kind of a labor-involved deal. Prevention, twice a year. Those of you earlier, Dr. Anderson mentioned that lepto is, you know, vaccines are going to last at best for a lot of those variations are going to last about 3 months, but 3 to 6 months is a good range in a beef herd. So, and this is something that gets missed a lot, right? Because we're vaccinating our calves, but then we turn around and we don't, you know, we just want to pour on the cows and we don't want to run all of them through. And so we miss doing those vaccines. And that's a vaccine. So when somebody that's in a modified live program, just doing that lepto vaccine alone is really all you're doing at that opposite time of your modified live. And so that becomes a lot of effort for one thing until this becomes a problem. And I've had producers with, you know, in 200 cows that we've had 30-40% abortion from lepto. And so that becomes quite an expensive experience there. So removing feral pigs, obviously for lots of reasons, that becomes a big issue that we could benefit, but that's one that we help. This is this VIROSHIELD 6 VL5, so it has your lepto in it. This is a standalone VL5, another Vibrio lepto product. All of those offer some really good protection there. So, calving difficulty. So this is the biggest one that I get. And clients ask me, hey, when do I know when to intervene if she's not progressing? Or when is this a problem? And so kind of the rule of thumb is intervene if no progress within an hour. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to sit there and go to try to pull that calf in an hour. That means that cow's out there laying down, and she's pushing for an hour, and nothing's happening. We should probably go get her up and figure out what's going on. If the cow's just up and down for an hour, that's probably not full-blown labor at that point, and we're not really at that time frame where we say, hey, let's go ahead and intervene. And so the thing to do with her is get her up, put a glove on if you have one, and check her birth canal and see what's going on. Doing this, intervening with 1 hour, is going to drastically increase your live birth. If you stick your hand in there and we've got a foot back, we obviously know, hey, this is time to do something. If you've got a normal presentation, a lot of times dilation of the uterus, or excuse me, of the vagina there, will cause that calf to, or to help that mother spread out a little bit and be able to progress that a little faster. So those are kind of things to do. If you haven't, obviously, if you have an abnormal presentation, it's time to intervene and or call your veterinarian, depending on your comfort level. So this one's kind of just a particular thing to me here. I get really particular and spend a lot of time, if I get one wrong, going back and making sure I get it right before I ever put tension on the calf. So big thing, making sure that this loop here is on the top part of the calf's leg, and that you do this half hitch. Do plenty of, or see plenty of problems, either lameness in calves or just fractures from someone just putting this top loop here. You know, I've, and probably everyone in here has seen, you put a calf jack on a cow, and you can move her with that thing. I mean, you can spin her around. So you're putting a lot of pressure on, realistically, an unformed calf's leg with open growth plates. And so a lot of pressure, especially right here, there's a really good growth plate that just likes to fracture. So that's where we see that problem. If you get this nice straight line that you see here, we get a lot of really good good traction on that kind of follows the axis of the calf back up to the shoulder. So, trick. This is something that, at least for me, gets talked about a lot, but tends to come and go for me. So I'll see it a lot for a little while, and then we'll come back around, and we won't see it at all for a year. And then, you know, then somebody will get it one, and then they test their neighbors, and the neighbors had it, and so on. So it's caused by Trichomonas. It's a venereal disease carried by bulls. So our bulls, cows have it, but they will clear the disease themselves. But the bulls are the harbor of this. And so the big problem is economic loss. We're going to see really, really early embryonic death. And so somebody that's got their bulls out for 6 months, we can see, you know, the cows just keep recycling. Because that calf is getting sloughed at 35, 40 days there. And so cow just keeps coming back in heat, and we wonder if the bull's working. Low preg rates, and then obviously, you know, in past times, let's say we keep our bulls out 6 months, and 90% of those calves are born in the first 100 days, and then the next year we shift to the end of the last 100 days there. So that's something just to keep in mind. Probably the most classic way that this, or the way that I see this, is somebody says, you know, the cow was supposed to start calving in February, and they bring her to me today, and we start palpating, and three or four of them are open, and five or six are 3 months bred, and then some of them you can just feel that they've still aborted, so maybe they aborted there at the end of that. So that's kind of the way that will show up. Oftentimes we'll see it, it'll just be, you know, on a larger scale, right? It'll be, especially when we have multiple service in that herd, you know, you'll have 10 or 12% open. And so we can see that. We test the bulls. There's pretty good research that shows that the testing of the bull, so we'll talk about the research on that, but sample taken, so we take that from the prepuce. It takes 2 to 3 tests to get most of our bulls tested. So say we have 30 bulls, that's what they did the project on, was 30 bulls that were positive. I think it was somewhere in the 80s those bulls tested positive on that first test that they knew were positive, tested positive on a subsequent test by the same practitioner. And then we jumped to 98% with the second, and then 99% on the third. So it's still, that disease can be kind of hard to find. And so that's something that, just to kind of keep in mind, that negative doesn't always mean negative, especially if your neighbor just had a bull that was positive for trick. In closed herds, test isn't particularly expensive or particularly cheap. So a lot of times for people, what we'll do is, especially in a good closed herd, you know, I'm going to say, hey, let's just test every other year, every third year, to try to manage, you know, our neighbor's bulls getting in or things happening that we're unaware of, especially on some of these larger operations. Let's test a bull every time that a new group of cattle that bull is exposed to a new group of cattle. And that may not be we're sharing with our neighbor. That may be I've got four pastures in three different counties, and so this bull this year we're going to take to this group. From a management system, that operation is a a totally unique operation to the other set. Even though they're managed by the same person, they're managed the same style, if we decide this year we want to change up our genetics and move this bull, it's a good idea to go ahead and trick test those bulls as we start to move between our programs, or if we share with neighbors. So your neighbor down the street has 10 bulls or 10 cows and wants to breed them and doesn't want to keep a bull or buy a bull, and so you help them out. Well, if they got all their cows from the sale barn that year and they had trick, well, then that's a problem. And I've seen that. So what the thing to do here is test that bull before it goes to your neighbor so he can't say you had that, and then test him when he comes back. And again, going back to that 2 to 3 tests, it probably does you good to test that bull twice. So treatment of affected herd, the state of Texas, because it's reportable, the state of Texas gets involved. That's not always very quick as I would like it to happen. Usually that's a 30 to 45 day process. Most people need to know sooner than that. They're either turning bulls out or they're going to be, some management practices are going to change within 45 days. They probably need to know that. So there's a vaccine. I don't use that vaccine outside of infections. The state used to require that, I believe. Now I don't even think they require that. The results with it aren't great. Now, if you're coming out of a trick endemic area or something, I think it's probably got some value. Positive bulls, slaughter only, and most places require you to declare that. So the real pearl is your neighbors have to test. And so that guy I was talking about that had 10 cows and 7 of them were open or aborting had shared the bull with his dad, and dad's pasture was next to a big client's pasture who had his bull pasture, and he had 35 bulls in that pasture. And so with one positive bull, he now had to test 35 bulls. So he was not real happy about any of that process. So foot rot, this is what we're going to talk a little bit more about. Like I say, this is the one that I see the most of. Just on a day-to-day, hey, let me bring this by and get this treated. So what to look for and things to look. I like all three of these pictures, or both of these pictures, but all three of these feet, because the foot here on the left, we definitely see that as a common way foot rot presents. So you have the swelling that shows up right here. She's lame on this foot. But I see a lot of foot rots that, somebody says, well, I think it may be higher because her foot's not swollen. And it looks just like this foot right here. She's non-weight bearing. It's a little deeper down in that foot. We get hoof testers on her, and you can find some pain. It's not necessarily an abscess in there that you can dig out kind of like you would in a horse, but you'll find those. We start x-raying those, and we find some areas of necrosis on the bone. And so I've seen both of these in cattle. This one here is going to be probably one of the more painful ones, right, with this open sore on the bottom. This cow is going to be really unweight-bearing, but a really, a pretty... This is probably the more common presentation. We do see these more often. The other thing we'll see is that as that abscess or infection burst out, we'll kind of see some splitting in here of the hoof walls as they burst out the top of that coronary band there. So the big cause and the way we get this is water. So as these cows start walking around tanks and things, we start getting our feet softened and we start getting microabrasions, and then we start seeing... the infection is allowed to come through there. When I was in Louisiana, it was always wet. So this is what we saw a lot. What I found moving to Texas was that the biggest time that I saw foot rot was as we went through really wet periods, and then it started to get really dry. So as those tanks started to recede, as those calves had walked around those tanks, we started to see really sharp edges where all those hoof prints had. So basically, they're walking through a gravel pit, and they're going to stand in the tank for 10 minutes. It's summer. They're trying to cool off. And then as their feet have gotten soft, they're coming out of that tank, and then they're walking across that ground, and we're getting these abrasions on the feet. And so that's really, everybody says, well, it's not even wet. I don't know why I'm dealing with foot rot. That's where I see more cases of foot rot in these drier areas than I do. Now, you get in East Texas, I think you're still going to see it more, when it's rained 12 inches in the last 2 days. So kind of... talk a little bit about treatment. So Drying the feet off, keeping them dry. So for us, right, we hospitalize those. I like a bandage if we go back to the one that has the open sore here. I really like a bandage on that one. The one that's got the swelling here, bandage isn't really going to do us much good. So we'll oftentimes put like a Nitinol wrap or some kind of biozide wrap on this one on the right here to try to help pull some of that out and also offer some anti-infective there locally. The other big thing to talk about is blocks. I don't do a lot of blocks. Dairy industry does a lot of blocks with feet issues. But for like this one on the right-hand side, that would be a really good one to clean up this unaffected digit, go in there and put a block on there, and then that thing will stay on there for 3 or 4 days. The bacteria that causes foot rot really likes lack of oxygen, and so the bottom of the hoof is a great place for lack of oxygen. So we get that hoof block on there, we open that up a little bit, and we get the air moving in there. That tends to kill that bacteria probably even better than some of the anti-infectives. Treatment, a lot of good treatments for Draxxin. And these are things that are labeled for that. Draxxin works really well. Some of my producers really like it because we can dart it. So if we've got a calf out on 600 acres and there's no pens, the best option a lot of times is to dart some Draxxin. It's expensive, right? We're talking 450 a cc, so a 1,000-pound cow is going to have, you know, she needs 10 cc's. And a $5 dart, that becomes a really expensive miss, though. New floor works really well, large quantity, so you're 6 mL per 100 to treat those guys, and that works really well, too. Exceed, probably the big drawback to it is behind the ear. Some people don't like that just because of that. Exceed tends to work okay. When I'm treating a lot of foot rots, like in the middle of the summer when those tanks are receding a little bit, I will usually kind of do my own comparison and just see what I feel like is working better. I use a lot of LA. It's a third of the cost. It really works good to penetrate into that tissue. And I don't generally find my success rate is all that different between LA, Draxxin, Exceed, or New Floor. And so if I can save a producer a third of that cost, kind of silly not to use it. Kind of always my big thing for foot rot has been pain relief. So I've always felt like if we can get those cattle walking on that foot, that tends to make that process heal faster. So whether it's pushing that necrotic tissue out, whether it's just getting them more comfortable and they're eating better and they're getting around, that's always worked well. So we've always had the option to use Banamine. I use a lot of Meloxicam. So that's a human product that we can use in a bolus to get anti-inflammatories that last 4 to 5 days. And that really works well because you've got 4 to 5 days where you're shutting down some of that pain receptor system to get that cow walking again on that foot. Just this year, Merck's come out with Banamine Transdermal, and it actually has a label for foot rot. And so really kind of excited about this product. Haven't used it a whole bunch on foot rots. I've used it a little bit. The duration's probably not going to be there as long as the Meloxicam, but it's a pour-on. It's got a menthol in it that helps carry it through the skin, and so we can get some really good pain relief out of Banamine Transdermal. So kind of exciting to see how that kind of shapes that, and kind of interesting because there's never been a drug that's been approved for pain like that in cattle. So big question, and probably more of what I see, right, is why failures of treatment of foot rot. So producers, right, are good at treating foot rot, and so we see these problems pop up. You know, somebody said, well, I've treated her 3 different times with 4 different medicines, and she's still not better. And so what do? So we come in, and that's kind of my rule. If you've treated her twice, I'm probably going to x-ray her. And so we x-ray them, and there's really not a lot of antibiotics that's going to fix what's going on here. I mean, there's draining tracts that are associated with this. This is a joint, I mean, no different than any other joint. And that bacteria has eroded that joint there, and we have this infection that's just not going to clean up. And so that becomes a big issue. And so we'll talk a little bit about what we can do for those and how we can get those to improve. Reinfection, I've got a case here in just a minute that's what happened to that bull. We spent a lot of money on him, and then he still got reinfected, and then we spent a lot more money on him. And then occasionally we'll see both claws infected, and then it becomes a ethical, what do you do with her? If she's got both claws infected and we're not going to respond to anti-infectives, she probably needs to go to the packing house. And if that's the case, We probably don't need to give her any medicine so that we don't have to deal with withdrawals. So if we've loaded her up on medicine, then we probably start talking about, you know, humane euthanasia and those type things. So, but that is a good example of I've treated her two or three times and this is not responding. So salvage procedure, we do quite a lot of these, especially so like May, June, as people are coming, as they're on wheat and it's starting to dry out a lot, we'll do quite a few of these. I really like these because they heal really well and they do really well. So you take that calf that has this x-ray and then you translate it into this. And so there's some concerns, right? So if this is a bull and this is his back leg and this is a back leg, he's not going to be able to breed a cow. Maybe we use it to get through withdrawal periods. Cows and bulls typically take a lot longer to get over this. The pain associated with this tends to affect them more than stocker calves. So kind of my general rule is under 800 pounds, we try to come up with some different option. So what we do at my clinic, this is right to be effective on a 6-weight steer, it's got to be affordable. You know, it's got to pencil out. So for us, $200-$250, this can happen, and that calf stays with us over a week, including antibiotics. I mean, you go in and you take this calf, and you just cut that toe off, we bandage it for 2 days, we pull that bandage off, it's probably one of the worst smells you can come up with after you've cauterized, had pus, and a bandage on in June. There's probably not a better smell. You pull that bandage off, we rebandage it, leave that bandage on for 2 days, and then pull that bandage off again, and that calf we usually send them home. So let's get her out in a pasture where they don't have to, you know, it's got a trough or something where we're not trying to walk around in a muddy area, and let's get back to work with her. Get their weight back on them, and they may not catch up with their cohorts, but at least we can have some option to regain some finances through this calf. The other reason to do this right in a cow or something would be to deal with withdrawal periods. So if she's had LA and her withdrawal period's 45 days, we've got a long time for her to suffer around and walk around with this. So we might as well do this and get this opened up. So that tends to work pretty well, especially in those lightweight calves. Other options. So this bull was bought in Virginia, lived in Texas 2 months, and got foot rot. So I don't think he had ever met hard soil, and this is what happened to him. So I don't have the original radiographs, but on the one on the left, you can see the little beads there. So well, he had that in that top joint, or the middle joint there, right here. And so what we did was we took and we drilled that out right here, and we packed it with bone graft or bone putty with antibiotics in it. So we packed it in there and then bandaged this and then did bandage changes forever. And I probably won't even admit how long I kept this bull because this was the first one I'd ever done, and I was, we're going to get this done right. This was a really expensive bull, and I have a long alley at my clinic, probably twice as long as this, and I would take him out there. Once he'd been better about 4 weeks, I'd take him out there once a day, and I'd go walk him to the end and walk him to the back. And that was all he'd get, but we just kind of tried to rehab him back so that he could go to work. So owner picks up this bull, uses him, breeds him. He does great. 6 months later, he calls me. He says, Peter, that bull's number was 34. He said, 34 is limping again. I said, really? So we bring him in, x-ray him, and the one on the right is, well, both these x-rays are what had happened. So the foot rot now is in the lower joint. So we did it again. So we drilled it out. This time at this level, you're drilling through the hoof wall. We drilled it out, packed it with antimicrobial beads, and then did the same process with him. We did not keep him as long that time. That bull got returned back to normal and is back breeding with cows in the normal cycle with him. He's just a really more expensive bull than he was when he bought him. So, preventions, in my opinion, there's not any great preventions. Fusiguard is a product, I'm probably not going to knock anybody's product, but not one that I've personally had success with. I keep messing this thing up. What'd I do? I broke it. Did I restart it? I couldn't have done that if I wanted to. So Fusiguard's not a really good vaccine, at least in my hands. We use I use Endovac Bovi a little bit. I use that a lot in Louisiana. It's a product that is a gram-negative vaccine. It's labeled for E. coli, and it's labeled for Pastorella. And we use that a lot in those people that have really, really high incidence of foot rot, that are really just treating a lot of cows year after year, and tend to have some pretty good effect out of that. Most of those people are in more humid areas or you know, around like Lake Bridgeport. I had a client that was like that. So the main, that's a really good rinse. And then CTC, right? So we can, that was in the past was something that we've always used. That's now a problem, right? Because through VFDs, we can't use CTC for foot rot. So if you happen to be in a place that has anaplasmosis and you're using it, maybe you get some benefit from that. But I think that's, you know, fewer and far between. I don't think that it probably helped all that much for the most part anyways. So, we're actually really fortunate. That's about the end of my stuff anyway. So we'll just probably leave it at that because I really wanted to open it up for some questions. So what's important to you guys, at least what I see, and how we can manage some of those things. So I think she wants us to use a microphone so that everybody who they're recording this can hear it.
As far as the issue with foot rot, if you have a recurrence, I had three head recently and hit them all with Biomesin 200, which I understand is similar to LA 200, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so hit them with that. Of the three, two had a recurrence within week and a half.
Okay.
My vet went back. I took him to the vet. He went back in with Exceed, and they all seemed to be fine. Should I start out when I see an indicator of foot rot, should I start out with Exceed, in your opinion, just to get it done faster?
At least in my hands, I don't see a difference. So I think there's a, I think that's probably a variation of how they respond. I probably go with a little bit higher dose of LA than probably what the bottle tells me to. I think that's probably a, maybe what some of the difference is. I think any of those products you're going to be fine with. Exceed's not that cost-wise, right? We're talking Draxxin and especially New Floor. Cost difference between that and LA are pretty extensive. Costs between Exceed and LA probably aren't that far out of whack. It probably is not a bad way for you to do that. For just first time she's had foot rot?
Or something I can't solve.
So for us, right, the you know, an exam, and you're talking $40 or so, somewhere in that range, whatever your cost of medicine. So in a normal practice, right, there's going to be some markup associated with depending on that cost of just keeping that product. And then usually in what you're talking about, we're going to be x-ray. So $70 to $100, depending on how many views we're taking to try to see what's going on there. And then depending on that, you know, for me, a lot of times we're just cleaning those out. You know, that exam fee kind of covers some of that. If we start trimming feet and things like that, I mean, there can become. So I would say a second level, I mean, I would, you know, your antibiotics are going to change that, but I would say $120 to $200, depending on your antibiotics, would probably be a fair guess.
What's the chances of you curing
it? I find most of my foot rot get better, right? I mean, outside of weird stuff, right, where we just have lots of problems, we get bone involvement. But I would say 75, 80% of those first and second ones respond to something. Is that fair?
Okay. Going back to the lepto in pigs, how does that transfer again to cattle?
So lepto is really, really, really hardy. And so as those pigs, so it's kept in the kidney. So as they're producing urine, it's shed through the urine, and then they pee in, you know, where they lay, and they're not very particular on that, right? So they pee into some of those stagnant water piles, their wallers and things like that. So cows go ingest that, gets transmitted back into the bloodstream, and then sets up shop.
And what about for your bull?
What's that?
What about for the bulls? How could lepto affect the bulls?
So bulls, really the way we're going to see that's going to be more of the kidney issues, you know, weight loss, things like that, liver affected, things like that.
Is there a way to treat the bulls for that?
oxytetracycline sometimes, penicillin sometimes. I don't have a lot of success treating those because, again, the biggest way that we're going to see that is going to be abortion, right? Somebody calls you and says, we're having some abortion issues. And maybe this is just client-specific, but it's really hard to take a 9-year-old cow that's in a body condition score of 1 and say, hey, let's sink $200 into blood work and urine culture and try to find out what's going on with her. So in those instances, that may not be, those don't usually get worked up, at least at our level in where we're at.
I have a lepto question also. Did you say that the vaccines are typically only good for 3 to 6 months?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. And that's just based off the type of bacteria that lepto is. It's really hard to get a good immune response. In general, bacterial immune responses are never as good as viral. So I don't care if it's blackleg or tetanus or whatever that may be. We never get as good immune responses as we do for viral things. Trick's going to be one of those also that gets a really bad vaccine response. And so those things just don't typically carry out really far. So
would you recommend more than twice a year?
As Dr. Anderson was talking about earlier today, 4 times a year is what dairies do. That's probably excessive because our management styles don't dictate that we can get them up that often, or most people's don't. I don't think 3 times a year is wrong. And in clients that we've either diagnosed or suspected that, we always move to 3 times a year.
Okay, and the last question is about the feral hogs. Are the feral hogs just carriers, or do they, in fact, suffer the same symptoms?
I honestly don't. They are definitely carriers. They are a host of that. I don't know if they actually die of it, though, or if the kidney. I don't know.
I mean, they seem to be immortal. So
yeah. Yeah, if it affected them, we wouldn't have wild pigs. So
on the lepto, how many strands of lepto is there, and how many strands does our vaccine cover?
So every vaccine's different. There's probably 2 or 3 that are really important. There's probably 4 or 5 in most products. So, and then occasionally you'll see some people that will get like Bratislava, which is a kind of a weirder one that's only, like, you have to buy like pig vaccines to give to cover for that. So it just really depends on what you're going to get. The other hard part too, right, is that when we start doing titers, let's say we have naive cattle that have never been vaccinated for lepto. We start pulling titers on these. Those cross-react with each other, and so you'll have titer response of all of them, and you have to say, well, we think it's this one, but it may or may not be this one.
So I asked this in the last section. Do we have titer tests for cattle for the diseases that we were talking about, lepto, whatever other diseases we have for cattle? Because I also breed dogs, and we have titer tests for before we give vaccines. Instead of getting vaccines, we
right.
titer them.
So, and this is because I very rarely do vaccine titer tests. What's the cost on those titer tests, do you think, for your dogs?
Oh, it's expensive.
Yeah, that's why we don't.
They're show dogs, so they're worth it.
Yeah, so, I mean, sure, we can do titers to everything, right? That's some of the original way we diagnose diseases. Especially if you're old like Dr. Anderson, that's the way we diagnose those diseases. Nowadays, we can look for those diseases a little bit better, but we still use titers in situations. So to go out there and say, hey, let's go spend $140 on a titer, or let's give a titer based off risk assessment, that's probably the better way. Because, right, if you have one pig that comes on your, or 20 pigs that come on your place twice a year, because, I mean, pigs, at least I see, are more seasonal in the way that they move through certain areas. If you say, I have 20 pigs that hit my coastal field every October, and that's the only time they're ever there, our risk may be low. So I don't think there's never a cookie cutter right to that. It's always based off risk assessment and how you move forward with that.
But doesn't a deer carry lepto also?
Every species can have, I mean, okay. Raccoons carry lepto, rats carry lepto. I mean, there's a bunch of those that are carried by, like I say, in urban areas, the biggest ways people quit vaccinating dogs for lepto because their Yorkie has a reaction to it, and then they turn around and they quit doing it, and then the mice is peeing on their dog food, and they get lepto, and the people get lepto, and it's a big deal. So. Yes, sir. Okay.
We worked our calves this year, and temperature was in the probably 70s or higher 60s. Once we got through working calves, northern blew through, temperature dropped about 30 degrees, and 3 weeks later we had respiratory everywhere. So is there anything like maybe a VIRASHIELD product or something like that that we could give the calf along with his black leg and his other injections to help that?
So when you're saying you worked your calves, you just gave them a black leg, castrated and branded them, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I always recommend giving some kind of killed or modified, depending on your type of program, to those calves. I mean, VIRASHIELD 6, just with no, you don't need lepto in those calves. VIRASHIELD 6 is a great product to give. Some of those others, if your cows are on a modified live program, give those calves a probably even better right then. We can give a modified live with a Pastorella. And then you're talking now how we market our calves, because we've got really good wean calves that are going to be able to fight that off.
Would that be effective like right now, like 24 hours after you stress them like we did? Would we have?
Probably not, but you're talking, so a calf's life goes from really stressful when he comes out to not that stressful when he's on mom, because mom fixes everything, right? She's got a full meal there for him, to really, really stressful. So a problem with a calf, you know, temperature changes on a calf that's 3 months old and still on mom is nowhere near the problems that we see on a calf that's just been weaned, because now we no longer have mom, we've been moved, we don't know where our water trough is, all those things are a problem. So your immune response is based off that or is influenced by that. And so as that calf is less stressed, we get a better immune response. So it's always going to be better than when you did it at weaning. You're always going to get a primer, right? So mom, if mom's vaccinated with some VIRASHIELD 6 VL5, let's use that as an example, and then she's going to pass some of that immunity on, and without getting into too much, you know, when are we blocking, you know, immune system, things like that. Ideally, right, we give that vaccine, we boost the immune system, then we come back at weaning, we boost that immune system again. So I will say this year is probably, with the huge fluctuations we had, I've probably seen more respiratory problems out of baby calves than I've ever seen, 100%. I think that's been a bigger issue than I would like to see. And that's, some of that's even been in some well-vaccinated stuff. So this temperature's been pretty tough on just about everything. So 70 and 30 within 24 hours is tough for anybody. There was somebody else back there. I'm not sure. They may have changed their mind, too. Oh.
What about pink eye?
So for pink eye, the question was signs for pink eye and problems with that. Everybody has a different opinion probably on pink eye. There's some decent products out there that cover the basics. There's some other things that come in that complicate that. Probably the biggest thing, right, is fly control, because flies are going to be our biggest vector for that. They're going to transmit eye to eye. And so in a lot of places we can get through some pink eye problems just with some aggressive fly control. When you start talking about people that have really, really bad pink eye problems, right, we can do some autogenous vaccinations. Those just take a long time to come, you know. If I buy stalkers this year and they have pink eye really bad, and then I make an autogenous vaccine, and then I come back and I get it after those have already went to the feed yard, and the next year I try to use it, you just end up chasing yourself on a lot of those things. So.
What about signs?
Signs. So a lot of times you'll just see watering. You'll see some edema in the eyes, and the eye will kind of look blue. You know, sometimes we probably category those in together with just ulcerations, right? I scratch my eye and I've got some, I mean, those same clinical signs show up. You get edema, you get scarring, those things. And maybe some people deal with it. I felt like when I was in school, I spent some time in the Midwest, and those guys tend to deal with that a whole lot more. And I don't know if their plants are maybe just, I don't know what that deal. Maybe their grass is taller. I don't know. Like day one too early, or like, you know, 2 to 3 months I think is fine. Again, either some people don't black leg vaccinate their cows, and I actually had a bull, and this, I meant to mention this earlier, but occasionally we'll get that, right, where bulls are forgotten, right? They don't get vaccinated. They don't, And I had a bull, it was a 5-year-old bull, went down there and he was dead on the ground, and I started touching all over, or was almost dead, started touching, he had black leg. And so it was like, this is a really expensive mistake here, you know. He just, maybe they squirted him with a dewormer, you know, once a year, and that was about it. But, so I don't think so. The gentleman right here had a question.
I have a question on tetanus.
Okay.
After castration, do you recommend that, or does it depend on whether you're banding and whether you're doing it surgically?
Yeah, I guess experience is probably based on a lot of that. I don't do a lot of tetanus. I use a lot of just straight Vision 7 when I'm cutting calves. They're open, they're draining, so I don't usually get too excited about that. I don't think you're wrong to do that. If I'm banding, you know, cutter bulls or something like that, always a tetanus. Yeah, always. So, and the products, the time frame that it takes for that to affect most of those products, Covexin, Calvary, some of the other, you know, Ultrabac 8 or whatever that do those, you're going to get a good enough effect, you know, efficacy there. We'll use some tetanus antitoxin truly in the face of, you know, problems there. So
small steers, you're not. Yeah. It's not a big concern if you're cutting.
I don't get too worried about it.
Okay.
Week. Yeah. So TVNBL does them, so we test them on Monday. They run on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or they used to. They may do it more frequent than that, but we send them in on Monday. They get them. They've got to incubate for 48 hours, typically, to kind of get the growth of the tissue they want, and then they'll run them. So, you know, a day of shipping, that kind of stuff. Yes, sir. No. We do that all the time, right? That's a general practice thing. But if I put my bull next to the guy that had trick, I'd test him 3 times. So, and then I'd probably test him 6 months again.
If there's no problems on the neighbors or yours.
And right, it's back to assessment, right? The risk is low. So, you know, if we start looking for diseases that aren't really there, right? Let's say you've got 15 bulls and 7 of them are affected, we're hoping we pick up one. Right, so at least we get that, and that's what the state's going to require you to do. If you have a bull test positive in your bull battery that was in that group, they're going to make you test the rest of those bulls at least one more time, and maybe a third, based off that research. So, and then the question usually I get with trick is how quick can we test trick? We pull a bull. I mean, if let's say he bred a cow, and that happened to be the cow that he gets infected with. Yeah, but most times it's been a couple months past, so you can pull a bull off that day and test him. I mean, you don't necessarily have to bring it. You know, if he's been over at the neighbor's pasture for 2 weeks, I'd test him when he came here. So that's the other time that I test bulls is when I pick them up from my neighbors. So, so. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Could you give us your recommended treatment protocol for scours?
Question was recommended treatment for scours. So depends on the part of the country you're in. In my clinic, we calve quite a bit of heifers for people. And so we struggle, right, because we calve in one of 3 pens, and then kind of my rule is they've got to go somewhere else within 3 days or we're going to deal with scours. I use a lot of multi-men, so 1 cc of multi-men at birth really tends to help a lot. And I was kind of always skeptical of that. And then until I calved out 40 heifers for one guy, all from the same place, and about 15 in scours were miserable. And we started hitting all those calves at day 1 with a cc of multi-men and really cut down on the incidence of the scours in those. Treatment from, it's dehydration is what's killed those guys. So anything from oral fluids, there's quite a few really good ones out there, so just oral fluids with electrolytes to try to help pull that fluid back into the GI tract. Anything from, if they're really bad, we start talking about bicarb and different things like that. But just general ones, we'll use probably because legally, right, we're not supposed to use Exceed and Baitril anymore because those things are both off-label. Exceed was probably the most recent one we'd use. So in that mindset, you could use penicillin, right? We're usually trying to kill E. coli. Generally in cattle, right, most things are manifested by viral problems, and then bacteria as opportunistic bugs take advantage. And so if we can get those bacterial bugs knocked back, we usually can see some relief there. You know, prevention, you know, you get other parts of the country, they use quite a bit of, you know, vaccines for E. coli or for just scour guard, you know, at 8 months bred. These management systems down in Texas don't typically do that. They've got the new intranasal corona vaccine. I have some people up around the Red River that use that quite a bit. So just kind of depends on where you're at, but those are kind of at least how I approach that. All right, well, thank you, guys. If y'all got any questions, I'll be up here for a little bit. Thank y'all.
Okay, sessions will resume at 2 o'clock. So if everybody wants to head downstairs for lunch at the expo, thank y'all.